birdcage. "Calder," she exclaimed, spinning around. "You're up early this morning." She stood between him and the cage, so he leaned to the side, trying to get a clearer look. It was no good. The sheet covered the cage entirely.
"Did you buy a bird?"
"I thought we would go out for breakfast this morning," she said, slipping into a chair. "The testament is almost finished, so we won't have much to do, which gives us a while to talk."
Calder sat across from his mother at the foot of the table. He couldn't suppress the thrill of nerves that shot through him. Did she know? Was she going to stop him? If she knew what he did about Candle Bay Imperial Prison, she would go to the authorities, and that wasn't enough. She believed his father belonged in prison. Calder did not. All this shot through his mind before Ulsa gathered herself and spoke.
"It's been almost 2 years since you came to live here."
"That's right. I do expect a party."
"And you've accomplished so much in that time," she said. "Arto tells me you're quite taken with the fundamental philosophers, and your fencing has dramatically improved. You might win a duel or two now, so long as you stay out of the arenas."
He straightened in his chair.
"If I can beat Cheska Bennett, I'll be happy."
Ulsa snorted.
"If the Emperor smiles on us, she'll drown at sea. But no, my point is, well, I know you were somewhat caught up in the whims of the Guildhead, but you did end up with a position in the Blackwatch nonetheless. The other watchmen have been quite impressed with your enthusiasm. You've certainly made it easier on me."
He allowed himself a small smile, though he wanted to laugh with pride.
"Soon I'll be doing your job for you."
She drummed her fingers on the table.
"I may be getting older, but I'm not dead."
From within the shrouded birdcage came a voice like a collapsing tomb.
"David!"
Calder jerked back, his hand going to the nails hanging inside his coat. Ulsa held up a hand to calm him.
"One of the things you'll learn as you spend more time among the Black Watch is that not all elders are the soul-devouring, grotesque monsters from the legends. Some elderspawn creatures are just strange, alien to us in biology and mentality, but not malicious."
He left the iron spikes where they were, pointing a trembling finger at the birdcage.
"Is there an elder in there?"
"An elder spawn, more accurately. I picked it up recently after it responded to one of our gentler summons. The guild has already dissected a number of this species, so they were simply going to be rid of it, but I thought you might appreciate it. To symbolize your membership in the Blackwatch, I suppose."
Calder was having trouble taking his eyes from the cage. He thought he saw something move beneath the sheet.
"What is it?"
"It is what's known as a bellowing horror, or more commonly, a bellows."
She stood and, with a little bow, flipped the sheet off the birdcage. Within the cage waited a creature so malformed and poorly assembled that it took him a few seconds to figure out which end was its head. When his eyes finally traced its contours, translating its shape to something that made sense to him, the image of the creature snapped into place like a solved puzzle. It was scarcely a foot tall, perhaps the size of a bird, and stubby. Built along the lines of a short, fat man, its skin was greenish-black, like the wood of the Testament, and it had a pair of tiny wings that looked as though they belonged on a bat. A green, hairless bat. Surely wings like that were too small to support its bulbous body, but if that were true, why had Ulsa trapped it in a bird cage? Its eyes, balls of formless black, glared at him from inside its leathery face. Its mouth was invisible, or perhaps non-existent, hidden behind a mass of squirming, worm-like tendrils. Several of those tendrils now squirmed around the bars of its cage, as though tasting, or perhaps chewing, on the metal.
"A bellowing horror," Calder repeated, still weirdly fascinated by the beast. "Why is it called—"
"Horror," it bellowed,
flaring its pathetic wings.
"Oh, I see."
Ulsa laid a hand on the cage, smiling fondly down.
"I call him Shuffles."
Calder couldn't help laughing.
"Shuffles? That sounds like a three-legged dog."
"Well, he sort of—"
She shuffled forward on the carpet, imitating its walk.
"Shuffles along, you see. I thought it was appropriate."
He couldn't speak.
"And I admit there was a cat in my youth, Mr. Shuffles."
"Ah, does this one not deserve an honorific?"
She leaned closer to the cage.
"To tell you the truth, I've never been able to tell if it's a male."
Ulsa looked at her son, Calder looked back, and they both laughed.
Finally, Calder waved a hand in Shuffle's direction.
Seriously, Mother, what am I supposed to do with it? Oh, don't worry about that. Many in the Black Watch keep such pets. It's like having a bird. I had a similar pet myself until it fell into the bathtub and dissolved.
She hesitated, and then added,
I wouldn't walk around with it in public if I were you. I can't imagine I would choose to do that.
With a flourish of her wrist, she tossed the latch on the cage.
Let's have you two get to know each other, shall we?
He tried to protest, but Shuffles had already pushed its way out of the door. It fluttered its wings as it jumped out of the cage, landing with a thump on the table. Its nest of tendrils quested in empty air. Calder leaned back in his chair.
Don't be afraid,
Alsa said.
It can't hurt you. She shrugged. At least, it hasn't hurt anyone so far.
She was right about the way the creature moved. It shuffled along the table like a child scuffing carpet, occasionally using its wings to hop a few inches closer to Calder. When it was a few feet away, close enough for him to look into the soulless black of its eyes, it leaped. Its wings buzzed like a hummingbird's, and it flew at his eyes. He shrieked like a little girl, throwing up a hand to defend his eyes. It was going to eat him. Fighting a man with a sword was one thing, but this monster was flying straight into his face. A heavy weight settled on his right shoulder, and something drew a wet line across his cheek. A scent like copper and fresh fish blew over him. When he opened his eyes a crack, he saw Shuffles staring back from half an inch away. Its tendrils worked in the air, occasionally brushing his skin.
I think it wants to eat me,
Calder whispered. Shuffles leaned closer to Calder's ear, growling with the voice of a malevolent earthquake.
Meat.
Ulsa walked over and ruffled Calder's hair.
It likes you.
As Calder and his mother sat in the back of the carriage, rumbling down to the harbor, an uncomfortable thought lodged in his brain. It wouldn't go away, jabbing him with every crack of the carriage wheels on the cobblestones. What was he going to do if he failed? If he and Jerry were caught before breaking his father out of prison, they probably wouldn't see much of a penalty. At worst, it was another case of a young watchman testing the limits of his authority, which the Guild had seen many times before. But what if they were caught after unlocking Roderick's cell? What if they couldn't sneak him out of the facility? If they did escape capture, it wouldn't be hard for the Candle Bay staff to figure out what had happened. Calder had attempted to visit his father every few weeks, after all, and he would become the premier suspect in any investigation. Of course, he had considered all that before. But now there was a new ingredient to his thoughts, a new note to his dark daydreams. If he were caught, what would happen to his mother? He hadn't planned on taking his father to stay at the Greyweather House. Not only would Ulsa never allow it, but it would be the first place Imperial investigators would check. However, the thought didn't bother him. Roderick Martin was perfectly capable of disguising himself, finding another place to stay. He had planned to let Roderick go his own way, then return to his life with Jyrene and Ulsa, swearing innocence. Now that seemed glaringly naive. If Calder failed and was caught, how much blame would fall on his mother? Would she be able to keep her position in the Guild? Would the Black Watch itself come under scrutiny with a crime committed by one of its members? What would Bliss do when two of her watchmen had disgraced her so thoroughly? Even if he succeeded, his mother would eventually find out. Would she turn him in? Would she demand that he resign his post at the Guild? No, maybe she wouldn't find out. He had to place his hopes on that. She might suspect, but she'd have no proof. For the first time, Calder was starting to realize how little he'd actually considered about the outcome of his plan. It was already too late. Jyrene would be preparing herself now. He had his own tools, invested and designed specifically for this operation, hidden inside the carriage, disguised as materials from the testament. The plan was going through, and he would free his father. But now he wondered if the price would crush him. Chapter 20. Present Day. When the testament pulled up to the long stone dock on the Grey Island, three people were waiting for them. One was a pretty Heartlander woman with a long white scar down the center of her face. She wore her hair in dozens of small braids, and instead of a black outfit, she wore an elegant purple dress that wouldn't have been out of place in the capital. Two men, wearing the same black outfits as the consultants on Nakothi's island, flanked her to either side. Their mouths were covered by black cloth, and they kept their eyes fixed on the dock. When Calder walked up to the edge of the ship, he sent a mental command to slide the ramp down. As soon as it was in place, the consultant gave a smooth curtsy.
Captain Calder Martin, it's quite an honor to meet you. My name is Carrion, and I am here to facilitate your visit to the best of my ability.
Calder gave her his best smile. Calder, but you already knew that. Should I introduce the rest of my crew?
That won't be necessary. I'm told you have quite a guest on board as well. Would you mind if he joined us for our meeting?
Nabarius? For a moment, Calder's mind raced. What if he'd been lied to? What if the consultants wanted Nabarius to be the next emperor as well? They could kill the whole crew as soon as they had Nabarius on shore. Carrion whispered something to the black-clad man on her left, then turned back to Calder.
I assure you, he will be far more secure on the island than on your ship. We will not let him escape, if that's your concern.
His primary concern was that Gerilis Teach could catch up to him at any moment, and if he didn't have Nabarius within easy reach, she would kill them all. But he didn't see that he had a choice. Help yourself, he said graciously.
Thank you, Captain.
Someone tapped him on the shoulder from behind, and he turned to see two different black-clad consultants supporting a still-bound Nabarius between them. Calder kept his expression pleasant, bowing the two consultants and their prisoner down the ramp. Where had they come from? How had they gotten on the ship without walking past him on the ramp? If they could do that, what had stopped them from killing him in his sleep weeks ago? He patted his jacket pocket, reassuring himself. You're not a helpless target. You're in charge here. Act like it. Calder strode down the ramp, calling back over his shoulder. Bandle, Foster, it's time to leave. Carrion raised her eyebrows in evident surprise.
What happened to your champion, Uzziah? And you have an alchemist, too, isn't that right?
Former champion, Calder corrected. He decided to stay on another island about a day back. He wanted to meditate in order to hone his skills or some such champion business. And our alchemist doesn't leave the ship if she can help it. Carrion's face was pleasant and completely unreadable. He had no idea if she believed him or not.
I see. Well, if you'd like to follow me, we'd be happy to accommodate you in our local chapter house. I have to tell you, Captain, we thought you would sneak onto the island from behind. We did not expect you to walk in the front door.
Calder tried to look as though the idea shocked him. We're both professionals. We should be able to settle this in a businesslike manner.
That's very mature of you,
she said. Her voice told him no more than her expression. She was walking alongside him, with her original two companions leading the way and the other two carrying Nabarius at the back. He stepped forward, brushing against her elbow as if by accident. He caught no vision. There wasn't enough intent in her dress for that. But he received a sense of her current mental state. Absolute focus. That was the only way he could describe his impression of her intent. Usually, when you got the chance to read a person's active intent, you picked up a whiff of their background and emotions. Not so with Carrion. She had a purpose, she knew what it was, and she was absolutely focused on that single point. There was nothing else for Calder to see. He took an involuntary step away, though he managed to keep a relaxed face. Was she human? How did anyone end up with such needle-sharp intent? Carrion turned her smile on him, and he tried to hide his shiver.
Please, try to relax. You're a client. We'll do everything we can to accommodate you as long as we're conducting business.
Yes, ma'am, Calder said quietly. Andal and Foster turned to stare at him. A staircase began at the base of the dock, winding up a grassy hill and terminating in a crown of a building. It was white and arching, almost like a Luminian cathedral, but it gave the impression of modern advancement rather than ancient dignity. Its glass panes, stained with a consultant's crest of garden shears, flanked the polished wooden doorway. Trees and benches lined the path leading inside, though Calder was sure no one ever casually strolled outside the headquarters of the Consultants Guild. He glanced behind the chapter house to the rest of the island and was surprised at how natural it looked. There were one or two shapes that may have been the tips of distant buildings, but other than that, the island was a sprawling, natural mix of hills, rocky slopes, and trees. "I thought you would use more of the island," Calder remarked, just before they entered the chapter house.
"We do," Carrion responded. "It's more use to us in a natural state, that's all. We wouldn't want it to look like the capital, would we?"
That's what he had been picturing, the consultant chapter house in the capital, which was nestled like the missing puzzle piece in the middle of 100 crowded buildings. Now that he thought of it, there was no reason why their private island should look anything like that. The gray island looked like someone had taken an especially large imperial park and transplanted it directly into the middle of the Aeon. The only thing spoiling the view was the rolling, misty background, making it seem like the sky was perpetually overcast. Only when he looked directly upward did he see a blue circle, like the eye of a storm. Inside the chapter house, Carrion directed them straight past the reception room. Calder was unsurprised to see that it was as well-appointed as the Imperial Palace itself, with priceless art decorating the shelves and gilt-framed paintings hanging on the wall. 500 gold marks, Calder thought, passing a Canali original portrait. It portrayed an ancient Aurelian general standing victorious after a battle with the Azirians. Not a single painting he passed would have fetched less than 400 gold marks at auction. In most parts of the Empire, that was enough to buy a house. And he'd thought navigators were well paid for their travels. Maybe he should have joined the consultants. The woman at the desk had hair almost as pale as Bliss's, and she stared at him with an iron gaze. For some reason, she kept her hands conspicuously tucked beneath the desk. Aren't receptionists supposed to be friendly? She looked as though she'd rather kill him and deal with his corpse than listen to a single word he had to say. Carrion kept walking without stopping, leading them down a red carpet marked with the moon in sun symbol of the Aurelian Empire. They finally reached a private room standing open, decorated in much the same manner as the reception room. A round conference table in the center, surrounded by padded chairs, took up most of the floor space. There was a hat rack in the corner, but he kept his hat on. "Thus do I strike a blow against my enemies." Carrion gestured for them to seat themselves.
"Can I offer you any refreshment? Drinks? Something to eat, perhaps?"
Foster cleared his throat.
"I could use some coffee, if you have it."
"Of course."
Andal shook his head, but Calder was interested in testing this out. "I could use a light lunch."
"Do you have any preferences?"
Perhaps he should have some sort of plan here, to trap them and show the consultants that he was in charge, but he was really just curious. "Surprise me." Carrion nodded to the back of the room, and when Calder turned to look, he found that Nabarius was being supported by a single black-clad consultant. His partner must have gone to get their order. Come to think of it, hadn't there been two more of them before? Where did they go? Nabarius was not led to a chair. They left him tied and gagged, scowling across the room at Carrion, standing against the wall and held by a black-gloved hand. Calder couldn't deny that he enjoyed the sight.
"Let's get right to business, then,"
Carrion said, brushing a few braids out of her eyes. She reached beneath the table, pulling out a leather satchel, which she set on the table. From inside the satchel, she withdrew a single phial.
"You're looking for the Heart of Nokothi, and for your wife, Jairine Tessella Martin."
Straight to the point. Calder could play that game, though it still unnerved him to think about how much the consultants knew. If they wanted to take over the Empire, what was stopping them? Why hadn't they backed Nabarius? "I'd also like a way to keep Geralus Teach from killing me and my crew," Calder put in. "That's a fairly important point." Carrion made a note.
"And you too, gentlemen. Anything you would like to discuss?"
"We're with him," Andal said.
"And you, Dalton. I'm given to understand that there's something we could do for you."
She pulled a different file out of her satchel, and Calder saw Dalton Foster's name in a tight hand on the front. Foster scowled at the file, no doubt upset at the thought of someone digging around in his past.
"Maybe later, on my own. For now, we've got more important things to do."
Carrion gave no indication whether she was pleased or not. She simply slid the file back into her satchel.
Of course. I will take the initiative and preemptively answer your questions while you enjoy your refreshments.
Was she going to wait until the food arrived? Calder glanced over at the doorway and then back to the table. A pile of chicken, rice, and steamed vegetables sat in a shallow bowl just in front of him, framed by silverware, a napkin, and a glass of orange wine. How did you do that? Calder asked, impressed. The corner of Carrion's mouth twitched up, and that smile actually looked genuine.
You know, that's the most common question I get. Would you believe I never answer it?
How could you?
Andal responded.
If you explained, the magic of the consultants would be gone.
She nodded to him, conceding the point. Foster simply sipped his mug of coffee.
While you enjoy that, Captain, I will lay out the situation. Your ship was attacked by an unknown assailant in Candle Bay, and your wife was taken.
Calder swallowed a mouthful of chicken. Not unknown, a consultant by the name of Shara.
Is that so?
Carrion asked curiously.
Did she introduce herself?
He waved his spoon in the chronicler's direction. Nabarius recognized her from the Imperial Palace. Carrion tapped her pen against the paper.
The second most common question I receive is regarding assassins. I'm afraid I have to tell you that the consultants do not employ and never have employed hired killers.
Calder gripped his spoon like a dagger, forcing a grin. Oh, really? Then who do you think attacked our ship dressed in all black?
I didn't say it was not one of our consultants,
Carrion said.
But tell me, did she actually kill anyone?
He thought for a moment around a mouthful of roasted chicken and seasoned rice. He didn't know anything about consultant cooks, but Urzaya needed to take lessons from them. I believe she took my wife, Calder said at last.
She did.
Well, that was easy. She had admitted to Jerry's abduction. Now it was just a matter of negotiation. He leaned forward, meal forgotten. So where's Jerry? Carrion flipped through the file, shuffling papers.
That which sleeps will soon wake. Does that mean anything to you, Captain Martin?
He took a sip of wine to buy himself time to think. I've heard it before, he allowed.
I thought you had. It's the credo of a group that call themselves the Sleepless. While the great elders sleep, these men and women stay awake and serve their interests. It's little more than a modern-day cult, and I'm led to believe that you've had some run-ins with them in the past.
I have. The latest only a little more than a year ago.
Then you're aware that your wife is a member of that group.
Andal and Foster exchanged looks, but they didn't meet his eyes. What did they think about this? There was no love between them and the elder cults, especially in Andal's case. Did they think Jerry was better off rotting in a consultant dungeon? That's one of many topics I would like to discuss with her when I see her again, Calder said. Carrion scribbled another note, and Calder found himself wishing he could see the file.
Let's talk about the heart of Nakothi.
As far as Calder was concerned, they weren't through with the subject of his wife, but he played along. The guildheads seem to think that you intend to destroy it.
And by guildheads, you mean Bliss, Jarilis Teach, Cheska Bennett, and Mackenzie Maxius.
I'm not going to ask how you know that, and I'll just say yes.
Very wise. While the guildheads are correct about our ultimate goal, they are mistaken regarding our methods.
She folded her hands on top of the file, meeting his eyes seriously.
We have a method to destroy the heart. But doing so without taking the proper precautions in the wrong way could be worse than letting it go free. Tell me, Calder, what did you think of the Emperor?
He was going to need a file of his own just to keep track of each time she changed the subject. I am a loyal citizen of the Aurelian Empire.
Off the record.
He was a suicidal captain who almost steered us into a cliff, Calder said. He was so much older and more powerful than anyone else that he thought he was beyond human. He wrote laws and traded lives like a great elder rather than a man just like anyone else. When I learned he was dead, I laughed until my sides hurt. Carrion nodded as though he had said exactly what she expected.
This may surprise you, but many of our Council of Architects feel exactly the same way.
That did surprise him. The average Imperial citizen didn't know much about the Consultants Guild, but two things were common knowledge. First, they would help you with anything so long as you had enough cash to interest them. Second, they were absolutely dedicated to the Empire. The Imperial Guard had its stories of traitors and rebels, but not the Consultants. To be a consultant, in the popular opinion, was to be among the Emperor's most dedicated servants.
"Humankind has never governed itself,"
Carrion went on.
"The Emperor did it for us, and as you pointed out, he didn't do so as one man ruling over other men. He borrowed the power of the Elders to stand above us as though he were a great Elder himself."
Calder started to think he might be able to come to an agreement with this guild after all.
"So, instead of letting the world develop its own leaders,"
Carrion continued,
"the guilds you mentioned seek to prop up an old and outdated system. Yet another emperor to rule the world for the next millennium."
She spread her hands.
"Why? The last emperor failed us in the end. Why try to recreate the perceived glory of the past when we can move forward into the future?"
Calder's personal dislike for the Emperor gave a little internal cheer at that, but another part of him protested. She was presenting the case as if there were only two options: another emperor like the first, or leaving the world to stand on its own. The Elders would consume a divided world in months. There had to be another choice. And there was Bliss's warning to consider, too. She seemed to think that a world without an emperor would be in grave danger. He knew her well enough to suspect that she wouldn't care who ruled the world, so long as it wasn't the Great Elders. That seemed like a wise enough viewpoint to him. Andal picked up the conversation when Calder went silent.
"How do you expect the Elders to respond to an empty throne? They feed on chaos."
Carrion's hand moved to touch the scar on her forehead, but she visibly forced it down.
"The Regents and the Blackwatch have handled the Elders for the past 5 years. There's no reason to suspect that the guilds can't keep the Great Elders in hand, along with whatever world leaders rise to the occasion."
"And look what the Regents and the Blackwatch have accomplished," Calder said. "The Dead Mother's influence grew to the point that the Emperor was killed and his successor is fighting over her heart."
"You seem well informed,"
Carrion said. Her voice and expression were entirely neutral, but Calder wondered if he was in danger. "The head of the Blackwatch is a personal friend of mine." An exaggeration, but Bliss would probably say it was true.
"And her right hand is your mother,"
the consultant finished.
"I understand. Still, you have a better grasp on the situation than I would have expected."
She straightened her spine, and Calder suddenly saw past her pleasant exterior. She didn't get that scar from paperwork.
"This isn't our usual policy," she said, "but I'm going to give you some information for free. First, we will be taking Naberius Claiborne into our custody. Once we find out what he knows, we will find a place for him."
Calder suspected that their place for him would be a mile under the Aeon Sea.
"Second, we do have your wife. She is alive and, as far as I am aware, completely unharmed."
He missed a breath. That had been so easy. All he had to do was ask, and they told him the truth. And she was unharmed. This was better than he had dared to hope. The best he'd imagined was that he would find Jerry after almost a month of torment and abuse. He had told himself that she deserved it for lying to him for years. But unharmed. It was almost too good to be true. So after his initial burst of excitement, he listened closely for the trap.
"You will be allowed a supervised visit with her for a strictly limited amount of time, after which you will leave this island with neither Naberius nor the heart."
There it was. "That's very generous of you," Calder said. "But I'm afraid we will need a little more than that. General Teach is on her way here looking for us. If we don't have one of the two, she will see us all dead." Carrion's smile returned.
"Then we do have business to discuss. Excellent. We're more than willing to let you stay on the island until circumstances have calmed. For a certain fee, of course."
A black-clad consultant walked up to Carrion, and once again Calder realized he hadn't seen the man enter. How did they get around like that? The consultant leaned over, whispering to Carrion behind his black half-mask. Her eyes snapped to him, then over to Calder.
A soulbound has breached Bastion's veil, she said. You don't know anyone who might have snuck on the island, do you?
Urzaya, they'd found him already. Calder exchanged glances with Andal, who shrugged. This could work out for them after all. It's probably my cook, Calder admitted. Carrion shut the file in front of her.
Urzaya Woodsman, she recited. Former member of the Champions Guild, exiled in bad standing, forced to serve a term in an Azirian arena until his debt to the Imperial throne was cleared or until his death. Liberated before his term was completed by person or persons unknown. The arena was destroyed in the process, its record lost. Later surfaced as the official cook aboard the navigator vessel known as the Testament.
He'll be pleased to know he has fans. The room was filled with black shadows now. A couple of consultants perched in the corners of the wall and ceiling, crouching like spiders.
There are those who would take this confluence of circumstances as an attack,
Carrion said flatly. Calder took another bite of chicken and vegetables, then placed his spoon down and raised his palms, showing that he was unarmed. I can't claim responsibility for Urzaya's actions. Do you believe I could have stopped him? Carrion gave no reaction.
Regardless, we still have business to conclude. I rarely have to ask this question, Captain Martin, but what do you want from us?
Calder looked around the room, which was crowded with consultants, and considered his answer. He wasn't sure how to put it. Everything had become too confusing to untangle. But there were a few things he knew. I want to talk to Jerry. Depending on the conversation, I might take her aboard my ship, or I might leave her here with you. I want something to keep Jerilus Teach from killing us all as soon as we leave the dock. As for the heart, he reached into his jacket, and one of the consultants pulled a knife. Calder raised his hands again, showing they were empty, and slowly slid his hand into the jacket, withdrawing a gold circlet with two fingers. The Emperor sits on his throne, considering the petitioners in front of him. He wants to give them mercy, but mercy is not what the Empire needs. Today, the Empire needs strength, security. I don't want either of you to have the heart. It's not that I specifically care what happens to it, you understand, but it could get in my way. You may not know this, but I have certain ambitions. Casually, he placed the circlet on his head. Carrion's eyes widened. She was on the table before he could react, a bronze blade in her hand flashing for his throat. Stop! Calder shouted. Everyone in the room froze. The weight of his intent pressed on them like chains, binding them with absolute authority. With all the intent contained in the Emperor's crown. He still had nightmares about the voyage to recover this particular Imperial artifact. But it was all worth it. Carrion crouched on the table, her blade halfway to his neck. Kneel, he ordered. The room filled with the sound of men and women dropping to their knees. Carrion didn't hesitate to kneel, bowing her head and pressing both fists to the surface of the table. Andal and Foster were still in their seats. Foster took another sip of coffee, eyes wide.
Holy dead mother, Captain. Did you know it would do that?
Absolutely not, Foster, Calder said cheerfully. I fully expected to die.
Huh.
The gunner drank some more coffee. When he first found the crown, Calder had run some tests. Like all objects the Emperor had personally used, the crown was far more powerful than a normal invested object. However, it still had its limitations. It added a little more weight to his commands, but just to the degree of suggestions, unless the target considered themselves a loyal subject of the Empire. The greater their loyalty, the greater the weight of his commands. He had considered awakening the crown, hoping that would allow him to control people perfectly, but upon further investigation found it impossible. The crown had such a weight of intent and a depth of history that awakening it could take decades. Even then, it might not work. The only man who could have awakened the crown would have been the Emperor himself. Without being awakened, the crown wasn't nearly powerful enough to control people against their will. Loyal guild members could still refuse him. He had simply hoped to use the crown to help persuade the consultants, not to take command. So what was happening here? Rise, Calder commanded experimentally. The consultants were on their feet before the word was fully out of his mouth.
Touch your head.
Hands went to heads all over the room. Foster chuckled.
Make 'em dance.
Carrion's eyes were wide, and she shook slightly. With fear or anger, Calder couldn't tell, but either way, he wouldn't want to meet her without this crown.
How did you do this?
She asked, voice tight. Calder tapped the crown. Fine headwear.
That much I understand, but our oaths shouldn't—
Quiet, Calder said. Her mouth snapped shut on the word. If they all survived this, he was going to have to try very hard not to encounter Carrion in the future. If looks were anything to go by, she would tear his heart out of his chest. For now, it was time to take advantage of his newfound authority. Members of the Consultants Guild, please escort me and my crew to your prisoners. You are to keep your mouths shut unless you are specifically addressed. If your fellow guild members ask you any questions, say whatever you must to allay their suspicions. Is this understood?
Yes, sir,
they said at once, even Carrion. Calder tried to stop his smile from spreading, but he didn't quite succeed. He reached for his hat, tossing it to Andal. He wouldn't want to cover up the crown in case that broke its effect. Andal shook his head, but he tossed the hat under his arm.
Let's go then.
They were on the way out of the room when Calder noticed who was missing.
Where's Nabarius?
A couple of the black-masked consultants glanced at one another before one volunteered.
He ran out as soon as we released him, sir.
And why did you release him?
You ordered us to kneel.
Of course.
Calder kicked himself inwardly, but outwardly he nodded. No point in worrying over past mistakes. He would have the whole guild out searching for Nabarius if he needed to. Come to think of it, how many people would follow the crown's orders at one time? Was there a limit? Would it wear off over time? Calder shoved the questions aside for later, directing the consultants out of the room. Together, the captain of the Testament, his two crew members, and a dozen consultants headed out of the chapter house, deeper into the Gray Island. The successful man visualizes success rather than failure, said Esthenes said. Well, Calder had imagined what a successful meeting with the consultants would look like, and this was much better. Chapter 21. Anyone may use an awakened weapon, but only a soulbound can wield power freely, as the Chimera do. It is therefore critical, when dealing with a soulbound, that you identify their vessel as quickly as possible. Until then, assume that they are capable of anything. Gerilis Teach, Captain of the Imperial Guard. 11 years ago. Calder's black watch coat was not the best fit on Jerry, but she wore black underneath and covered any gaps in her costume with raw confidence. She'd watched her father at work since she was a little girl, and she remembered how everyone else deferred to watchmen. They were the guardians who stood in the gap between normal people and unspeakable threats. Or, possibly, they were the acolytes of the elders, drinking blood and carrying out indescribable rituals to bring about the end of the world. Either way, common sense said to run from anyone with a Black Watch badge. It had confused her to no end as a child, wondering why people kept scurrying away from her father or refusing to meet his eye, but today it served her well. She marched her way into the Candle Bay Imperial Prison with a forged document in her pocket and wearing a look of determination like a mask. She had spent hours practicing her makeup, trying to make herself look old enough that they wouldn't see a child, just a young watchman about her duties. The receptionist was just as Calder had described, pretty but empty, with a smile that made Jerry want to shiver. But a watchman wouldn't be bothered by a doll's smile. In the Black Watch, that level of strangeness wouldn't merit a second glance. So Jerry slapped her fake guild paperwork down on the desk and stared the receptionist in the eyes.
I need to speak with whoever's in charge of this facility. Guild business.
Just in case the woman missed it, Jerry tapped her badge. The receptionist's smile remained undented.
I'm sorry. The administration cannot be reached without an appointment.
Jerry sighed as if she ran into stubborn bureaucrats every day.
Listen, I am a duly appointed representative of the Black Watch Guild, and I have tracked an elderspawn to this very location. We're sweeping all the buildings in the area, just in case, but I will be searching this building for signs of an elder infestation with or without your cooperation.
The receptionist smiled down at the desk as she scanned the paper.
Elder infestation does qualify as an emergency situation. Please wait while I call security to escort you deeper into the building. Thank you for your paperwork.
She pushed Jerry's fake papers back across the desk, then turned to pull a bell cord that would doubtless summon guards. Jerry tightened her fists in her coat pockets to prevent them from shaking with excitement. This was it. The thrill of infiltrating a prison with nothing but her wits. The tang of danger. She hadn't felt anything like it in years. The Sleepless promised a life full of risk and purpose, but they delivered very little on their promises, as far as Jerry could tell. They only pushed for what they wanted, like when they ordered her to steal the testament. The Sleepless had sent her to the Greyweather household in the first place, though she'd never learned how they managed it. They commanded her to get a look at Ulsa's secret project and then to get it out of the Black Watch's hands. She hadn't managed to persuade Calder to steal the ship, and the Sleepless would be furious at her failure, but she was past caring about their approval. The more she learned, the more she suspected that the Sleepless knew little more of the Elders than she did. Jerry would be able to serve their cause better on her own. Her coat bulged in the middle, rustling, but she pushed it back down before the receptionist turned around. When the guards arrived, Jerry didn't explain herself to them. She flashed her badge and walked straight through the door to the back of the prisoner's cells. The guards hurried to catch up, but they were too in awe of her to do anything else. Every 20 or 30 seconds, she would stop in the middle of an empty hallway and close her eyes, waving her hands in front of her as though sensing arcane vibrations.
"The energy here," she said. "I can sense the residue of Elderspawn. It's very close now."
Covertly, she pushed her bulging coat back down. The guards remained pale-faced and shaking, one of them drawing a circle in the air to ward off elders. From what Jerry knew of the elder races, an invisible circle wouldn't help any more than it would against a hungry tiger. But if the gesture calmed them down, that very peace might actually protect them, so she said nothing. Finally, they reached the cell that Calder had indicated. It looked no different than any of the others, but Jerry froze. The guards skidded to a halt around her, clearly on the verge of bolting. Jerry spun and pointed down the hall to her right.
"There!"
she screamed. They turned around so fast she thought their necks might snap. As they did, she reached into her coat, withdrew Shuffles, and tossed it down the hall to her left.
"No, behind you!"
she called, pointing at Shuffles. The monstrosity had buzzed its wings to ease its fall, landing with a soft splat on the floor. It shuffled down the hall, surprisingly quick in its awkward gait. One of the guards screamed,
"It's a monster!"
At the sound of his voice, Shuffles turned its nightmarish head around, staring at the guard over its shoulder and one stubby wing. The tentacles that served for its mouth writhed, and its eyes glared black hate.
"Monster!"
Shuffles echoed, hopping down the hall after them. The guards could not wait to scramble away from the Elderspawn, pushing each other down and grabbing at the walls in their haste to escape. Shuffles let out a disturbingly deep and masculine laugh, shuffling along the tiles for a few feet before it hopped into the air and fluttered a few yards closer. At first, Shuffles had disturbed Jerry. She believed in the supremacy of the great Elders, but that didn't mean she couldn't be unnerved by Elderspawn. Now, she wanted one. From her pocket, she withdrew the copper key that Calder had lent her. She was no reader, so she didn't need to keep it wrapped in a handkerchief. She simply pulled it out and tapped it on the cell's lock, hoping it would work as easily as Calder said. She didn't hear anything happen, so she tapped it twice more. She still heard nothing, but when she tried the knob, the door swung open. Roderick Martin had been sleeping, but his eyes snapped awake as she entered. He sat up with a smile just like the receptionist's.
"Hello, young lady," he said. "What can I do for you?"
He wasn't exactly the mirror image of an older Calder that Jerry had expected. He was built heavier, for one thing, and his frizzy hair and beard gave him a wild look. But between the smile, the pale skin, and the red Azirian hair, she had no doubt that this was Roderick Martin. Jerry hurried inside, shutting the door behind her. Then she made straight for the window.
My name is Jairine Tasella. I'm here to open the window.
Roderick's smile shook. Are you going to let me jump? Not for the first time, Jerry wondered what they were doing to the prisoners in here, and if the Emperor knew what was happening under his nose. He probably did. The Emperor had done much worse than this in his time. He was no fit keeper of the world.
You won't need to jump,
Jerry said, in what she hoped was a soothing tone.
I'm a friend of your son's.
Like a newborn calf testing shaky legs, Roderick rose to his feet.
Calder, is he here?
He should be right outside,
Jerry assured him.
So make sure you don't jump. You might land on him.
She looked for a place to tap the Emperor's key, but the window didn't seem to have a latch. She tapped the copper all around the window frame, just in case, but the window remained sealed. From the hallway behind her, she heard Shuffle's deep, echoing laughter and the boots of more guards hurrying her way. It was time to improvise. Jerry spoke in the tone she had learned from her father and his colleagues when dealing with civilians.
Mr. Martin, please turn and face the wall.
Obediently, Roderick turned and stared at the featureless wood of his cell wall. He didn't ask questions. Jerry took a deep breath and reached up, massaging the emerald gem of her left earring. She was no reader, so she couldn't feel the power building in both matching pieces of jewelry as they woke for the first time in months. But she could feel them when they finally flared to life. After all, every soulbound could feel her vessel. She drew a finger down the edge of the window frame, her touch trailing green flame. Where the blaze touched, it drilled straight through the wall. If she couldn't open the window, she would cut it free.
Burn it all down,
her instincts whispered.
Let yourself loose. There are bedsheets behind you. They will burn. There is a lit quicklamp on the wall. Shatter its glass. Release the burning fluid. The man behind you, he will burn.
Her vessel didn't speak to her in words, but in impressions, in impulses, in pressure to do things she had no desire to do, to use all of her power and burn the world to the ground. But it was no more difficult to resist than hunger or anger. Her soulbound vessel was part of her, its desires welded to her own. The window came free, and she had to grab it with both hands to prevent it from pitching out the wall and potentially landing on Calder's head. The edges had cooled unnaturally quickly, so they did not burn her hands, but she hadn't made it any lighter. As she strained under the pressing weight of the window, scrambling to keep it from crashing to the ground or unbalancing her, she realized that she had never appreciated just how heavy a pane of glass could be.
Mr. Martin,
she grunted,
help me.
Now under orders, he turned swiftly from the wall and gathered up the severed window in his hands, awkwardly taking half of it from her. As the first guards pounded on the door, demanding to know what was going on inside, the two of them set the glass carefully against the wall. Roderick leaned out the hole where the window used to be, precariously close to the edge. The wind smelled of salt and icy winter weather, but he drew in a long, slow breath. Jerry laid a hand on his shoulder and guided him back from the edge, just in case.
Don't worry, Mr. Martin. Calder will have our ride here in just a moment.
She hoped. When Calder's raft sank, he knew he was going to die. He'd been sure the raft would hold. He spent all afternoon investing it, meditating over each board with specific intent. It shouldn't have broken apart or dipped beneath the waves for anything short of a falling elephant. He'd rubbed a drop of his blood on each board to bind his intent closer to the material. He never figured out what he had done wrong, whether his intent had conflicted too much, whether he hadn't focused enough, whether the intent in each invested board had fought the power in all the others. He didn't have time to think when his raft drifted apart, leaving him to plunge into icy water. Calder had no doubt that this was the night of his death. First, Candle Bay was directly connected to the Aeon Sea, that haunted ocean of 1,000 different terrors. For every unfounded ghost story and sailor's tale of the Aeon, there were 500 monsters and phantoms all too real. This was the sea where the Black Watch fished for elders. They'd spent the past year trying to summon elders into this very bay. He didn't know what waited for him beneath the waves, but he knew it must hunger for his blood. So that was his first concern. His second? The water was cold. When his head first dunked underwater, he almost gasped at the sheer, shocking, bone-stabbing cold of the winter water. He only avoided inhaling a chestful of icy seawater because his lungs were frozen in the grip of the frigid waves. He pulled desperately at the waves, paddling with numb limbs, hauling his bag of invested tools along with him, though it seemed to weigh as much as an anchor. All the while, visions of circling sharks and grasping elder tentacles haunted his mind. In his imagination, the black bay beneath him was packed so full of terrors that they scarcely had room to swim. Calder was somewhat puzzled when, 5 minutes later, he found himself alive and dripping on the rocks beneath Candle Bay Imperial Prison. He raised his arms above his head in a kind of champion's salute, and he would have shouted had his mission not required stealth. He had conquered the freezing water and escaped the unnamed monsters of Othagor and Akhmagut.
Take that, Candle Bay. Bow before me.
Then he realized that the wind was blowing through him like a frozen spear, and his wet clothes clung to his body as close as his skin. He had to admit, this might not be the best time for celebration. With shivering fingers, he undid his pack. All of his tools were still accounted for, and none the worse for their dunk in the bay. Water couldn't wash away intent. The first item, a rope made of knotted sheets stolen from the Greyweather residence, weighed the most. He wrung as much water out as he could, half surprised that the moisture didn't freeze to slush before it reached his feet. When the knotted rope was somewhat dry, he swung it like a lasso over his head and slapped it against the wall of Candle Bay Imperial Prison. Calder had spent the most time on this particular item, and it bore months of his intent. As soon as the cloth struck the wall, he focused his intent once more, pouring it into his makeshift cloth, reminding it of its new purpose. To climb. He had explained the disappearance of 8 linen sheets on a disastrous trip to the laundress. Alsa hadn't trusted him with the laundry since, which was a nice secondary benefit. The cloth rope slithered up the side of the wall, directly under his father's window, which, he suddenly noticed, was a slightly melted square-shaped hole in the wall. The Emperor's Key hadn't done that. How had Jerry and his father managed to burn a hole through metal and stone? Had Jyrene gotten her hands on some weapons-grade alchemy without telling him? The cloth crawled inside the cell, and a pair of tan, slender hands grabbed it. Jerry's head poked out of the hole, her earrings swinging and glinting gently green in the moonlight.
Imagine meeting you here, she whispered down. Have you seen an older gentleman, about my height, with flaming red hair? I seem to have misplaced him.
Jerry began climbing down the rope, which he assumed she had tied to something on her end, since she didn't collapse to her death on the rocks below. A moment later, his father followed. Calder couldn't help the grin that swallowed his face at that moment. They weren't safe, not by a fair shot, but they'd still done it. His father was out. Jerry jumped the last story, landing a little unsteadily on the rocks beside him. He seized her shoulders to steady her, but she didn't seem to mind whether she fell or not.
Calder, there's a little problem I may not have mentioned.
From above came the sounds of a heavy crash, followed by splintering wood. Seconds later, two heads poked their way out of the window.
Stop! Hold it right there!
The other man started shouting about a break. Roderick stopped entirely. He turned to the guards, as though he wondered whether he ought to start climbing back up.
Father!
Calder called, no longer trying to keep his voice down.
Come on!
Roderick shook himself and started descending, recklessly fast, sliding so that he must have burned his hands, kicking the wall whenever he got too close. As he reached the rocks below, one of the guards pulled out a pistol. Calder hadn't needed most of the invested tools he'd brought, so he upended his bag over the bay and shook it out. Then he raised the last device he'd prepared that might prove somewhat useful. The bag itself. The pistol rang out. The ball struck the bag and rolled off, as ineffective as a thrown rock. Instantly, the bag started to come apart at the seams. All Calder could do with his intent was enhance the properties of the bag. The material itself was inherently weak. With another year, he thought he might manage to make the bag permanently bulletproof, but for now it would unravel after another hit or two. Jerry huddled under the spread bag with him.
Nice job. Where's the boat?
At the bottom of the bay.
She eyed his soaking clothes.
I see you've made a trip down there yourself.
Roderick was only partially covered by the bag, sticking his head out to keep an eye on the guards above.
Maybe I should just go back.
Calder ignored him, his mind churning. A reader is never unarmed, as Laura Lee, the strategist, had once said. He started to catalog everything available to him. His rope was already unraveling, intended to last only a single use. He had a few wet sheets, his own soaked clothes, an unraveling bulletproof bag, his black watch coat, a bunch of rocks, and water. Lots of water. Water was useless to a reader. Intent was carried in the structure of an object, so liquids were poor repositories. Legends were still told of Joran Mazewalker spending years of his life investing a bottle of water until a drop of it could cleanse a curse. That served as an illustration of exactly how uncommon the practice was. Tales were still told of a legendary reader who managed to invest a single bottle of water after years of work. Panic began to swell in Calder's chest. Until this point, he had been sure that he'd be able to come up with something to get them out of any situation. It hadn't occurred to him how completely reliant they were on the raft. He should have found a way to test the thing, but he had been so sure it would work. Above them, red quick lamps flashed to life, and a dozen alarm bells began to ring. Jirene huddled close to him.
I know you're the reader, but if you could hurry up and think of something, I would feel a lot better.
How long do you think it would take them to shoot us if we tried to swim for it?
How long does it take to load and fire a musket?
Already, musket barrels were emerging from all around the prison roof.
Surrender your weapons, a man called. Return the prisoner! Drop the bag!
Second by second, the crushing weight of reality bore down on Calder. They had failed. They were all but caught. His father would go straight back to the alchemists and their experiments. His mother might lose her job and would certainly see him as no better than Roderick. Jerry? Well, they would return Jerry to her family. She, at least, should be safe. And Calder would finally get what his mother had feared for him 2 years before, a cell next to his father. A cell where he would sit day after day and fondly imagine throwing himself out the window. The image filled him with new purpose, and he dropped the bag, leaving his empty hands raised in the air.
We agree. We agree to your terms.
He exaggerated the shivering in his voice, but not by much.
Please, just save us.
Stay where you are,
came the man's voice.
Give me my coat,
Calder whispered to Jerry.
I don't know, it's cold out here, and I'm quite comfortable.
But she was already climbing out of the coat, eager to see what Calder had come up with. It wasn't much. He was going to see if he could invest enough intent in the jacket to get it to float, and then send his father out in the bay, using the jacket as a makeshift flotation device. Since it was black, it should blend into the night water, and his father might be able to cover his head with it and float at the same time. It was a weak, desperate plan, filled with holes, but it was the best he could come up with. He had to try something. Then Jirene handed him the coat, and he felt his seven nails clink against each other inside. Inspiration bloomed like light in a cave. He fumbled through the jacket like a blind man, finally managing to extract one of the nails. When he did, he looked from Jerry's face, still excited, to his father's lost expression.
Trust me, I'm not crazy.
Using the tip of the nail, he scraped a bloody gouge out of his hand. Jerry gasped, and his father moved forward as if to stop him, but it was too late. Calder jumped back into Candle Bay. Chapter 22. Present Day. Nabarius shrugged off the ropes as he staggered down the hall of the consultant's chapter house. He'd been working his intent into the bond since the second they wrapped the rope around his wrists, so when he was ready, the whole bundle came apart like rotten rags. With his hands free, he tore off the cloth gag in his mouth, taking his first full, deep breath in days. When he was emperor, he would make Calder Martin and his crew feel what they had done. He would tear them apart. And then he would remake them. It was his purpose. He realized that now. The heart sang to him here, from across the island. After so many years in the witnesses, he thought he'd experienced everything life had for him. Readers could see visions of the past, goals for the future, dreams and hopes and nightmares all bound up into the objects that people used every day. He thought he knew how the world worked. But the heart of the dead mother had a song unlike anything he'd ever experienced. It drew him, tantalized him, taught him. Simply from the feel of it, the cool lullaby, he knew that he would unlock the secrets the world had never dreamed of. Hidden knowledge of life and death. He would be the wisest man that ever lived. With that thought, he shook days of captivity from his mind. Who cared what Calder Martin had done? In the scale of the world, the sheer scope he'd seen when he read the remnants of Nakothi's body, Calder Martin was less than nothing, the ghost of a dust mite compared to a towering mountain. Nabarius focused himself. Even in his own mind, he hated babbling. He straightened his coat, corrected his stride, and walked with perfect self-assurance out the back door of the chapter house. Nakothi's song guided him. The heart was on the other end of the island, in the back, and a little beneath him, as though someone had taken it underground. Were they trying to hide it from him? He smiled only to himself as he stepped into a copse of trees that appeared natural and found a raked path. The way was clear before him. Soon, he would destroy this world and birth it anew. Though Jerry was no reader, she still had to press herself against the back wall of her cell to escape the heart. Its icy grasp gnawed at her like a dog with a bone, whispering promises to her. "You can be free," it said. "You can be made anew. Your husband doesn't understand who you are. You can change, or you can change him. Rebirth comes for all." Those who listened to the elders for too long went mad, she knew. Even those who could not read intent, those like her who did not see straight into the truth of the world, could not stand more than the briefest glimpse into the minds of the elders. "They are older than we are," her father had once said. "Wiser, stronger, more intelligent than all of mankind put together. That is why we must be so careful. The lies we tell ourselves are what allow us to perceive the world at all. Crack those lies, and the human mind is like an egg with a cracked shell." She hadn't understood her father's words until years later, and she had never experienced such an object lesson as right here, right now. The heart spoke with the purpose of Nakothi, but the dead mother's intentions were strange and alien. Jerry had to learn what she could, then put that power to good use. At the moment, she wasn't interested in learning anything. She simply wanted it gone. This was not the first time Nakothi's heart had visited these cells. Its power came and went over the past 2 days as someone carried it to Lucan for him to inspect. Every time the heart visited, the dead mother's voice grew louder, and that affected more than just Jerry's peace of mind.